Welcome to Chapter 8, Meditative Concentration. All the chapters we've been doing this far are building to this chapter. So now this chapter and the next chapter actually give us the training of actually becoming a bodhisattva. So you've been doing all of this work to get to this point. So this is a really fabulous, fabulous chapter, and I suspect you'll find it very, very useful. So in the earlier chapters, we agreed that an open heart, the word we use for that is bodhicitta, it's a combination of loving kindness and compassion, is the most important thing in life. That's our most important goal. We agreed that we have to calm our minds in order to do that. We have to deal with all of our raging emotions in order to do that. So we got all the instructions on how to become less chaotic and less crazy. Then we had all the instructions on, again, becoming really enthusiastic. This is what we want to be passionate about. And now we get the really clear instructions. And this chapter I find tremendously interesting because not only does he give exquisite instructions, so profound that they're used in every single text that follows this text. He's quoted continuously. But he adds a couple last things about calming our mind, which again brings up all of our reactions. So I'm warning you ahead of time, you're going to go, but. And he's going to say, now I want you to really think. In order to calm your mind, we have to really let go of all the fairy tales that we have about life. There's no happy ever after. Nothing in samsara is going to be happily ever after. I want you to think like a scientist and really analyze things so that your mind can become completely peaceful. And when your mind is completely peaceful, then you can really use the training and work with the training. And the training that he gives is first, it's called equalizing self and others. So in order to benefit beings, to start living your life really so that you're helping others, in order to get to the point like the great Buddhas and Bodhisattvas where you can even offer your life for others, first you have to really understand and be convinced that you and the others are the same, that there's no difference between you and another person. Then you have to exchange yourself for others so that the other person is first. They're going before you. And then the ninth chapter is neither of you exist ultimately. So he's building up in such a way that you can absolutely have your heart wide open and do what's ever needed in any situation to benefit beings. So it gets really fabulous. And we'll focus today on the last calming practices and the equalizing self and others. So verse number one, after cultivating diligence, set your mind to concentrate, for those whose minds are slack and wandering are caught between the fangs of affliction. So, you know, we could see even in the short shamatha practice that we did this morning, often when you're sitting quietening your mind, suffering of the past comes up, worry about suffering of the future comes up, or even discomfort. I know my knees are getting achy, discomfort in the moment comes up. So we have to be able to pacify our minds in order to concentrate. So we're remembering that, and he's reminding that. And in this chapter, he's trying to help us see the more subtle calming that we need to do, the calming of the more subtle thoughts. So we know if we're really angry at someone, we're not calm, right? We can see that we're in a rage and our emotions have taken over our mind. But what we don't see so often is, like, even sitting in this room, our minds are registering yellow. They're registering different faces. They're registering light and dark, cold outside. And every time we get a sense thought, it's another kind of thought, we're also going, whether we realize it or not, I like this or I don't like this. So we have lots of kinds of thoughts that we just take for granted that we don't think of as discursive thoughts, but we want to pacify even those thoughts. So he's asking us to go a little further. And he says, in solitude, the mind and body are not troubled by distraction. Therefore, leave this worldly life and totally abandon wandering. So this is the first but. I didn't sign up this life to be a nun. Kemo may be a nun, but I didn't say I'd go and leave worldly life. So what he's talking about is, in order to understand the training, you do have to create solitude. You do have to create retreat situations for yourself. It doesn't mean that you have to become a monk or nun. You can leave worldly life by staying in worldly life. But it does mean you have to create that complete solitude of mind. This is a quote from Kenshin Kongcha Gyaltsen. When you have sincere non-attachment to samsara, wherever you find yourself can be a supreme place of solitude. So it's cultivating non-attachment. And then we look at what are we attached to. And basically, you know, if we cut out most of the things we think we're attached to, we would still have family and friends and some possessions, maybe our house, maybe our car. So now he's saying, okay, let's look at this like a scientist. You know, when we think of wanting to be loved, and often it's because we want something. So there's no problem with loving people. The problem arises when it's our need, our craving about loving and having cozy company, with the sense that that's going to solve all our problems. So there's no problem with loving, it's our attachment to the friends and family and our fear of being alone with our minds. Like we have to have always company around so that we're not sitting with our minds by ourselves. See what I mean? There's no problem with loving people. The problem is the attachment. Do we have to be exactly like Milarepa? No. Do we have to concentrate and train in concentration and create a very simple environment so we're not distracted? Yes, we have to do that. So I wanted to mention there was a great teacher in Thailand named Deepa Ma Barua. She was actually the teacher of many of the famous Vipassana teachers that we think of today, Joseph Goldstein and people like that. She was married, and she wanted her husband to go let her be in a monastery, and he said no, and in that era, it was not possible for her to do that. In a short time, she lost her parents, so that responsibility was gone for her life. So she moved to Calcutta, and with her daughter and her sister, she created a monastery in the middle of a gigantic apartment building. So she made her apartment totally clear and peaceful. And the daughter would go to school, and she and her sister would meditate. And she started teaching all the neighbors in the apartment building to meditate. So she helped everyone see that in this apartment, in the middle of a giant city, in the middle of no wealth, just very simple circumstances, you can create that place of solitude of mind. It has to do with attachment. It has to do with, you know, do I have to run downtown for coffee? Or are we out of my favorite food? I have to have it for lunch today. Or what's at the post office? All those things that are distracting to us. And then simplifying our environment. If you, like here in the nunnery, we intentionally keep things very simple. Like we don't put bright colors on the walls. I have lots of friends who are, you know, doing interior design with lots of bright colors. But we keep the whole environment calming. We put pictures on the wall that remind you to go back to meditation. No giant TVs. So we're creating a situation where you can create solitude of mind. We're saying realistically, if you know your mind is jumping around, realistically, you have to create the conditions, the internal solitude, whether it's in a retreat cabin or in your house, that allows you to see all the different kinds of thoughts. And then you have to pacify all of those thoughts. When you hear something, it's almost as though you can feel ear leaping out. In the old days, they almost felt that the senses leapt out to touch a sound or a sight because it was that strong of the mind being pulled towards the object of sensation. So we want to calm our minds. And then when our minds are in the process of becoming calm, we want to look at why we want solitude and why we want to leave the worldly concerns. How are they causing us trouble and difficulty? The reminder that nothing in samsara is permanent bliss, all of samsara's impermanence, unlocks our mind from the unrealistic hope, from the habit of ego wanting out. We know how much our ego wants to be happy and wants out of whatever mess we're in. So this calm is the precondition to meditate in a manner that uncovers wisdom. Wisdom is what is truly going to benefit beings, not sitting around chatting, right? And so when we're looking at the idea of renunciation, sometimes we think about it as this is what monks and nuns do, but the actual language that helps us is weariness or nausea, or sometimes they use the word disgust. And the reason they're using those words, so the translation gets very interesting, is we want to become weary so that we are attracted to the solution. So if you look at teenagers, for instance, and you know how they're continually getting crushes on people, and then their heart is broken, and then they get another crush, and then their heart is broken. There's that sense of wanting someone who's going to in some way make your life happier. So when we see that pattern in our lives, and it's one of the basic patterns, and we see really how much pain and suffering is caused all around the world by this kind of unrealistic dependence on relationships, then we start to say, okay, I want to go to the root of suffering. I want to become compassionate and wise myself and love in such a way that I'm benefiting the beings, not just the people in my family, not just the people that I immediately care about, but to use that love I feel for my family to extend that same depth of love to absolutely all beings. Do you see what I mean? So we're looking for the solutions. He goes even further, and one of the commentaries was by Zigar Khantro Rinpoche. And if you look at Zigar Khantro Rinpoche, who is married, and Thich Nhat Hanh, they're saying we have to look at this unrealistic hope and this desire because it's a fairy tale we're telling ourselves over and over again. If we look at how quickly people get divorced and then they hate each other, you know, it started out with this unrealistic hope that all my problems will be solved by this perfect partner, and then you don't want to be in the same room with them. Or then we can get to the inappropriate relationships where you fall in love with or have a crush on someone that's totally inappropriate. And we look to see all the terrible pain in the world that's caused by loving children inappropriately, for instance, or the fall from grace of all of these wonderful people who all of a sudden have, you know, very silly affairs, and, you know, their whole lives are, all the good that they have been able to do in the world comes crashing down around them. So he's asking you not to look at the fairy tale, but to look scientifically. And when we're looking at these kinds of things, it reminds me sometimes of the Cherokee wedding ceremony, because in the Cherokee wedding ceremony, they look at a couple coming together so that the couple can support each other in benefiting beings, support each other in manifesting their gifts so they can be more effective in benefiting beings. So you see how love can be greatly beneficial as opposed to a need on our side that's a more self-cherishing, I want to be happy, so I need the right person. This is what he's saying. We want to look at that so that we can, for a time, be in solitude. Not necessarily forever, but to look at solitude as a tool to see how your mind works. Then your mind becomes calm, but that's not enough. So if we look at verse 4, penetrative insight joined with calm abiding utterly eradicates afflictive states. Knowing this, first search for calm abiding, found by those who joyfully renounce the world. We're not seeking to become calm. We're seeking to look at what is the root of suffering and pull it up by the root. And I always think that that's a really good example this time of year. So in our gardens, we have these giant ferns, and the roots go so deep, and they're like an iron rod. Barbara and I were like pulling on these roots, and you have to dig 3 feet deep to pull up these roots. So we're trying to find what are the more subtle roots and the more subtle roots and the more subtle roots. Now, if we were to continue, beings brief, ephemeral, who fiercely cling to what is passing, will catch no glimpse of happiness for many thousands of their future lives. So here we are, ourselves, brief and ephemeral, going after things that we think will make us happy, but those things themselves are brief and ephemeral. In various verses, if I long and crave for other beings, my thoughts are all for them, and by degrees my life is frittered away. So people always think, when am I going to have time for practice? When am I going to have time for a retreat? And then we're caught up, well, July is 4th of July, and August is Labor Day, and here's this celebration, and this party, and that party. And you look back, and all of a sudden, the whole year has gone by. So again, I want to reiterate, it's not the loved one, but the unrealistic hope that love will solve our unhappiness and dissatisfaction. And Shantideva is trying to help us see that this kind of craving and desire are covering up our opportunity to discover our innate awareness. That discovery of our innate awareness frees us from all of our attachments and unlocks great compassion. So if our mind is always on ourself, what do I need in this moment? It's not on how can I help this being or that being. So we're going more and more subtly so that our mind is spacious and free, and the activity of the mind is how to benefit others. Then we get his sense of humor coming in again. Oh, foolish and afflicted mind, you want, you crave for everything. This everything will grow in turn to a suffering increased a thousandfold. That's verse 18. Since this is so, the wise man does not crave. For from such craving, fear and anguish come, and fix this firmly in mind. All that may be wished for will by nature fade to nothing. So now he starts addressing our craving for possessions. He gave us a chat on friends and family, and now we're going for possessions. Everything that we think we want will, by nature, fade to nothing. The new car in a year or two is the old car. And then it's the heap of junk. When he's addressing all the different kinds of things we crave, he addresses what we call the eight worldly concerns. So he looks at human nature and says, okay, there are basically eight categories in terms of what we feel like we want. One is simply gain. We want lots of things, so we're attached to having wonderful things. And the opposing fear is we don't want to lose those things. So you can see that we vacillate between hoping we get the newest iPhone that's not out yet, and fearing that someone will steal it. We want pleasure and happiness. We don't want pain and unhappiness. We want to be praised. We want to be praised for everything we do. We want everybody to think we're a great person. We don't want to be blamed for anything. We don't want to be slandered. Nice to be famous, have everybody recognize you, have a good reputation. We don't want to be disgraced. So you say, if these are the basics, then let's look at them. So verse 21, why should I be pleased when people praise me? Others there will be who scorn and criticize me. So even if everybody in your workplace thinks you're the greatest, one person is going to be criticizing you. I'm always reminded that even the Dalai Lama has people who don't like him. So even the greatest people in the world that you can think of have at least one person who is criticizing them. Then another one I really like from verse 22, people have so many wants and tendencies, even Buddha could not please them all. No one can please everybody. We have so many desires. You know, you can throw the greatest, most beautiful party in the world, but there's going to be somebody who's sitting there going, huh. I could have made that cake better. 23, people scorn the poor who have no wealth, right? You can hear the politicians always saying, well, they didn't try hard enough, they didn't work hard enough, and criticize the people who are rich. So the poor people are then saying, those people shouldn't have so much money, they're doing something wrong. So he's saying, you have to leave all these worldly concerns. They're not helping you, If you're not hoping one day about one of these, you're fearing about the loss of it. So he gets into solitude itself. When may I be free of fear without the need to hide from anyone? With just a begging bowl and a few belongings, dressed in garments coveted by none. Now we're going into the recognition that simple contentment in the moment is our greatest wealth. We're losing interest in worldly concerns, not because we're not passionate about life, but we're passionate about what is the cause of suffering and how can we help people. So we're turning our passion and enthusiasm into how can we benefit others, as opposed to, I want this for myself, I want that for myself. Still, our troubles are not over. So there can certainly be then fear for your greatest possession, your body. This body, now we're at verse 31, now so whole and integral, this flesh and bone that life has knit together will drift apart, disintegrate. And how much more will friend depart from friend? Relinquishing all other aspirations, focusing myself on one intent alone, I'll strive to still my mind and calming it, bring it to subjugation. So you're calm, you're in the place of solitude, and you're really looking at the suffering that you're seeing in your own heart and all around you. In this and every other world, desires the fertile parent of all conflict. Here in this world, bonds and wounds and death, and in the next, hell is prepared. So with really great compassion, instead of just saying you should get rid of desire, he helps you see that you have desire and that the aspect of desire is that's not beneficial is your neurotic aspect, your need, as opposed to, as I was saying before, loving people. So what do we do when we have this desire? And this, I think, is tremendously interesting for when things are inappropriate. When you look at some of the difficulty and pain that people are in, we tell people, oh, you shouldn't have inappropriate desires, but we don't give them any tools on how to conquer those desires. I was listening to this incredible thing on NPR, and it was about a young boy who recognized in his early teens that he was attracted to children. And when he was a child and he found that he was attracted to children, he just thought, well, I'll grow out of it. But then when he was a teen and he saw that he was still attracted to children, he could see, well, nobody else is like this. And so he didn't know where or how to go to help. And he went to a therapist, and the therapist didn't know how to handle it and shamed him. And he didn't want to tell his parents, but the therapist brought the mother into the session and then shamed him in front of his mom. And all he was doing was asking for help, seeing that, oh my goodness, this is the way I'm wired. There's something really wrong with it. I don't know what to do about it. So, you know, it was really admirable that he wanted to do something about it. And so what I think is quite wonderful is Shantideva goes with us through a series of contemplations that addresses the attraction of the body, which in our realm, you know, of course, is so tremendously prevalent. And sometimes it's a little more gender specific because he was teaching men, but this translation is more gender neutral. And so I'll just do a couple of these verses, and I encourage you, this is another one of these but things. You know, we love to love. We love to hug and kiss the people that we treasure. And he helps us to lose the neurotic aspect of that. Let's look at verse 42. Of what in truth is nothing but a heap of bones, devoid of self, without its own existence? Is this the only object of desire and lust? Sooner pass beyond all suffering and grief. Verse 54. But it's the skin and flesh I love to touch and look upon. And then he says, well, why then don't you wish for flesh alone, inanimate and in its natural state? He's asking you to really look at what you're attracted to when you get consumed. So, oh, you can think, I love this person. Their skin is so soft. It's so wonderful. Well, if that's really, you know, what you're loving, then, you know, why not the skin by itself? He's helping you to see through Why go to such excess to clean and polish what is but a weapon that will injure us? The cares that people squander on themselves in ignorance convulse the universe with madness. We can all remember our teenage years, you know, when we're just learning our, you know, the power of our gender, and we get tons of makeup, short skirts, all these things, and get all that attention. What we squander on themselves in ignorance convulses the universe with madness. So it's a desire realm. We can see how desire gets confused. I'm sure everybody in their life has had at least one confusing moment with some teenage angst or even recent angst. Then he says, okay, what is the other way we waste our lives? And he addresses workaholism. And so now we're at verse 75. Some ambitious for advancement, not knowing how to get it, sell themselves. Happiness eludes their grasp, and pointlessly they live in bondage to their masters. Pretty direct how easily we can slide into a situation because it's a really well-paying job, has really great benefits, and then we see, oh my goodness, I don't have a minute of free time, a minute to go to a Dharma talk, a minute for retreat. And then verse 79, the trouble guarding what we have, the pain of losing all, see the endless hardships brought on by wealth. Those distracted by their love of riches never have a moment's rest from the sorrows of existence. We can see when the stock market crashes, you know, how devastated people are, how confused they are. They had sold themselves in bondage to get all the money, and then they are in deep depression because they've lost it all. So we're talking about being content with a modest life so that you have what you need, so that you can focus on the meaningful part of life, which is learning how to open your heart in compassion and learning how to benefit others. Then another really graphic example, verse 80, they indeed possessed of many wants will suffer much trouble, all for very little. Mouthfuls of hay the oxen get as recompense for having pulled the cart. So he's looking at how hard it was the ox to pull the cart for the farmer. You know, you see the ox practically half dead pulling this heavy weight. He does all of that, and ox is convinced to pull the cart for a mouthful of hay. And so he's asking us to look, are we creating our lives in such a way that basically we're using all of our lives for possessions that are like a mouthful of hay in the long run, in terms of this precious human life and the opportunity for enlightenment? And again, for those who are new to these talks, it's not to be meant to be read in a critical tone of voice, but it's like he's teaching himself, and he's sharing his enthusiasm of his own inner voice. So, for instance, even in monasteries, you know, you get caught up in all the work of administration, and then, you know, unless it's greatly benefiting people, you know, it could be that you've turned it into work instead of benefiting beings. All that we desire is sure to perish, and afterwards we fall into hellish torment. The constant minor troubles we endure are all for what amounts to very little. But with a millionth part of such vexation, enlightenment itself could be attained. If we put our time and energy into our Dharma practice that we put into a new job, we could get enlightenment. Not maybe that fast, but we could spend our lives with that enthusiasm focused on our Dharma practice. Some of the great Rinpoches have been tremendous about encouraging their sanghas to just get jobs that you could leave and go back and forth to, so that you can take retreats, go back and earn some money, take more retreats, go back and earn some money, not getting caught up in fame and possession. Then he goes back to, all right, now you're really ready for the instructions. You know why you want to be in solitude, whether it's in retreat or in your apartment. You know that once you're in solitude, your friends say they're a party, you're not going to go, because you know that you want to uncover your own wisdom, right? The shamatha, just like the shamatha we do in the Sunday meditation, is a training, full control of your mind. When it's moving, it's going in virtuous ways that you want it to go, and when it's still, it's like Mount Meru. All the the stability is not caught up in any of the sensations in the room. It's not caught up in the past or the future. It's immovable. Reflecting in such ways as these upon the excellence of solitude, pacify completely all discursiveness. Pacify completely like a still ocean. And cultivate the mind of bodhicitta. Now he gives the key instructions on bodhicitta. At verse 90, strive at first to meditate upon the sameness of yourself and others. In joy and sorrow, all are equal. Thus be a guardian of all as yourself. And again, the next few verses in terms of equalizing self and others are the first part of the training. And what I find so interesting about Shantideva and so unique about Shantideva is all the world's religions would agree. Treat others as you would treat yourself, right? The golden rule is across all religions. But what's so helpful is this progression of training logics that he starts with now. So we want to meditate on these verses over and over and over again so that we start to really see how we get caught up in our ego and how, in fact, we are equal to all other beings and all other beings are suffering just like ourselves. We can so want to protect ourselves, and this helps us dissolve that barrier that is cherishing the self first. So we're looking at how the I and other arises. And where is that basis? Where do we start tricking ourselves to believe there is an I and another? So what he says is, in reality, in an ultimate way, it's like the sky. And you can't cut a sky in half with a knife, right? It's not possible to do. So we have trained ourselves to think there's an I and another. But in reality, it's like the sky. There's no dualistic I and other. So for me, I'm the I and you all are the other, right? For you, you're the I and everyone else is the other. If there were a true I, there would only be one I. This I and other is something that's a dependently related thought. You starting to follow me on that? There can only be an I if there's another. And what he's saying, what we want to get to is like the sky that you can't cut into a dualistic. We're at verse 90. One should earnestly meditate on the equality of oneself and others in this way. All equally experience happiness and suffering, and I must protect them as I do myself. So this is the golden rule. This is the universal quality. We all equally experience suffering, and the scientists have even done experiments with amoebas that even amoebas want to run away from suffering. Verse 91. The hands and limbs are many and distinct, but all are one, one body to be kept and guarded. So when we think of ourselves, when we think of this self, we think, okay, this is my hand, this is my arm, this is my foot, and I'm going to keep this me safe. I'm mentally saying to myself that this is the me and everything else is not me. Likewise, different beings in their joys and sorrows are like me, all one in wanting happiness. So you, just like me, want your body and all of its parts to be safe. I'm going to read you another translation of this verse. And this is one which gives another insight, which is very important. Just as the body, which has many parts owing to its division into arms and so forth, should be protected as a whole, so should this entire world, which is differentiated and yet has the nature of the same suffering and happiness. So why is it that we disconnect from others? Because you're also made out of parts. Why do I let my sense of self end with this part and not with this part, or not with Carrie and all of her parts? And why does it stop, you know, with this land that I live on? And why does it stop with this state or this country? They're all different kinds of parts that I've trained my brain to think of as me and mine. But it's an arbitrary thought. So as much as we have trained ourselves to see this as self, we can also train ourselves to see all that is as self. Or all that is as one. No self, no other. So he's asking you to look and really think about why is it that we think that just these parts are myself. There's a wonderful book that was written, Jill Bolte Taylor, and she's on, if you Google her, she's on the TED Talks. And she had a stroke. Her book is called The Stroke of Insight. And when she descended into the mind of someone who was recovering from a stroke, she didn't separate her body from the rest of life. She experienced people who came in and out as essentially part of an extended feeling mental system that was her mind. Okay, now 92. My pain does not in fact afflict or cause discomfort to another's body. Through clinging to my I, this suffering is mine, and being mine is very hard to bear. So if my knees hurt, right, it's hard for me to bear, it doesn't hurt you. And so I tend to cling to this pain as my pain. And so this is terrible suffering. Oh, because it's mine, it hurts me, right? It's not hurting you, so no problem. Okay? And another being's pain I do not feel. And yet, because I take them for my own, their suffering is likewise hard for me to bear. So when we start extending ourselves to another person, then because we're thinking of all beings as my, then their suffering becomes as hard to bear as our own. So you can think of that in your families, any of the people that you think of as near and dear. When they're in pain, it hurts your heart. Okay, so you have this capacity already to see the pain of others as immediately something you want to release. You know, think of a child who's sick and how you would say, oh my goodness, if I could take this on, I would gladly take it, just so they would have relief from it, from those people that you care. So you can see how you start to extend beyond just your simple body yourself. Since I and other beings both, in wanting happiness, are equal and alike, what difference is there to distinguish us that I should strive to have my bliss alone? He's asking you to use logic. If the pain we feel is so difficult, and we think our suffering is so very difficult, and Carrie's pain across from me is so difficult, and I know that she's just like me, that when she feels pain, it's terribly, terribly difficult, why is it that I think my pain is more important than her pain? You know, logically, why is it? What is there that's different? Other than this arbitrary thought of self and other. Just like me, anyone suffering anywhere feels it as harshly. Now we're at verse 97. Okay, he goes through, we read 95. Since I and other beings both in wanting happiness are equal and alike, and verse 96, we want to flee suffering alike. All right, so we all want happiness just as desperately, we all want to avoid suffering just as desperately. Why is it we think that our lives are more important? And we can think of that, you know, across the planet. Now, 97, since pains of others do no harm to me, what reason do I have to shield myself? And let's just do the first two verses. So I don't have to guard myself from others' pain because it doesn't hurt me, right? But why to guard my future pain, which does no harm to this present me? So what he's saying in this verse is so interesting. We think somebody else's pain doesn't hurt us. So we have no reason to guard ourselves from others' pain. And at the same time, we are continuously guarding ourselves from our future pain. What he's saying is when we look at things, the present me is not the future me. We are already trying to prevent somebody else's future pain. So why not just prevent all pain? You follow me so far? He's giving us lots and lots of tools to look at this. To think that I will not have to suffer it is in fact a false conception. In the present moment, I will perish, and at a later time, another will be born. From a Buddhist perspective, in each instant, it's a new consciousness, instant to instant to instant. And we think we will not have to suffer a future pain so that we don't have to work to prevent that future pain. At the same time, we are always trying to prevent future pain. So he's getting to, no matter how you look at it, it's pain itself that's the problem. Then he's his counter voice, 99. It's for the sufferer himself, you'll say, to shield himself from injuries that may come. So, Carrie, your pain is not my problem. It's your problem to protect yourself from your future pain. But the pain felt in my foot is not my hand, so why, in fact, does one protect the other? This verse I find really, really helpful. If you stub your toe, right, your hand immediately goes to your toe. So your hand and your toe are not the same, right? But your hand, which is not your toe, immediately wants to alleviate the pain of your toe. And we just went through how arbitrary it is that the self we're protecting ends here. So we want to get to the point where any pain anywhere is in our own heart, our own. Just in the same way we'd automatically protect our toe, we would automatically protect the child crying across the world. Because there is no self and other that makes a barrier to the immediate response to that suffering. See how he's slowly taking you through this exquisite logic? I find it just absolutely exquisite. If one thinks that the suffering that belongs to someone is to be warded off by that person himself, then why does the hand protect the foot when the foot does not belong to the hand? I love reading the various translations of these verses, particularly the significant ones, because they give you just slight variations. Now he goes and takes you a little bit into the wisdom chapter, a little bit more into emptiness. We're at verse 101. Labeled continuities and aggregates like strings of beads and armies are like mirages. If we look at it from the ultimate perspective, the self doesn't exist, the other doesn't exist on its own. It's a relational conception. Then you might say, from an ultimate perspective, if there's no one really existing, then who's actually hurting? I don't have to do anything. And he goes, no, you misunderstood. When we're teaching emptiness, sometimes that is sort of a nihilistic response that people start to come to. If you look at it that way, that means your suffering doesn't exist. And so if you're hurting, there's no reason for you to protect your pain. So we know immediately that that's a false conception. Now we've gotten all the way to 103. Thus, the suffering of everyone should be dispelled, and here there is no debate. To free myself from pain means freeing all. Contrarywise, I suffer with the pain of all beings. We open our heart, we let down all barriers, and we see that the suffering anywhere is my suffering. Because at this point, we're equalizing self and others. So any suffering anywhere. I was asking Venerable Dahani once about the Tonglin practice, when you're visualizing taking in the suffering of others. And I was saying, well, that actually helps set up for, after a certain point, it starts help setting up self and others more. You're doing this for someone. And she goes, oh, but if the pain are all cries inside your own heart, then it's different. By freeing yourself from pain, you free all beings from pain. And freeing all beings from pain frees yourself from pain. I really encourage you to reread this whole set of verses and contemplate them as often as you can, this group in particular, because they're quite beautifully and purposefully set up to help you dissolve the barriers that see someone else's suffering as not your problem. Now, verse 107. To those whose minds are practiced in this way, whose happiness is to soothe the pain of others, will venture into the hell of unremitting agony as swans sweep down upon a lotus lake. When all being suffering is your own, there's no distinction between self and others because your heart is open. You're not attached. You're not attached to one person being more special than another person. Then you can walk into war zones the same way a swan goes into a lotus lake. It is your great joy and delight to work for the suffering of other beings. And it's that easy. the swan going into the lake. Verse 110, just as I defend myself from all unpleasant happenings, however small, likewise I shall act for others' sake to guard and shield them with compassion. These are actually my favorite verses. Verse 90, one should earnestly meditate on the equality of oneself and others in this way. All equally experience happiness and suffering, and I must protect them as I do myself. Just as the body, which has many parts owing to its division into arms and so forth, should be protected as a whole, so should the entire world, which is differentiated and yet has the nature of the same suffering and happiness. Therefore, I'll dispel the pain of others, for it is simply pain just like my own, and others I will aid and benefit, for they are living beings just like my own. Thus, the suffering of everyone should be dispelled, and here there is no debate. To free myself from pain means freeing all. Contrarywise, I suffer with the pain of beings. Look at verse number 104. Often when we're learning how to dissolve the barriers, and particularly with the Tonglin meditation, there's some advanced Tonglin practices in which you intentionally breathe in the suffering of others. And when we're first learning that, our reaction almost universally is, oh my goodness, what if I actually catch it? What if the pain takes hold? I'm a little afraid of feeling the vastness of others' pain, and I'm afraid that it will be overwhelming and it'll be too much for it. Verse 104 is very beautiful. The sorrow felt in pity aggravates, you say. The pain is already felt, so why engender it? But how can the sting of pity be compared with all that other beings have to suffer? We often worry that if we open our hearts, it'll be so overwhelming we won't be able to do anything. And he's saying, you might have a feeling momentarily of being overwhelmed, but what is that feeling compared to the actuality of the mom in the war zone today? So don't be afraid of that. Go right into that. Verse 105, if through such a single pain a multitude of sorrows can be remedied, such pain as this a loving being strives to foster in himself and others. You have to suffer a small discomfort in order to benefit beings. And through that small discomfort can alleviate the suffering of many, many beings. Then this pain a loving being will cultivate. I'll gladly take that on in order to benefit others. We think of some of the great Rinpoches, Garchen Rinpoche. He can barely keep his eyes open anymore to read the text to people. But if a relatively small pain of opening his eyes to read the text can benefit hundreds of thousands of people, he gladly takes that on in order to benefit beings. And then back to 110, just as I defend myself from all unpleasant happenings, however small, likewise I shall act for others' sake, to guard and shield them with compassion. Convincing yourself to take time for solitude when we have so many fun things to do is hard. Thinking about how do I love people without being attached to them. Separating our responsibilities to a confused person might have a baby so that someone would love them unconditionally, as opposed to by having a baby, I will love them unconditionally. This is what he's pointing out. As opposed to reacting, just think about what he's saying about friends and family. What are our responsibilities, and how is that different from attachment? Joanne is asking about solitude. Does that mean retreat individually or retreat as a group? So in the U.S., we use the word retreat quite broadly. So he's saying at some point, you have to look at your own mind quietly by yourself. It can be in a group where no one's talking to each other, but it means you sitting down and looking at all the different kinds of movement of your mind and you seeing for yourself what are the different things you're attached to and letting go, letting go, letting go until your mind is perfectly, perfectly calm. And it doesn't have to be by yourself in a mountain. For instance, Joanne is a wonderful person who takes care of many friends and family, has a lovely, wonderful husband. Distinguishing what are your responsibilities, when you're not working on your responsibilities, how can you sit on your meditation cushion and sit in deep quiet to look at where your mind is and what you need to do to see what kinds of things distract you and let go of those distractions. And it doesn't mean forever. It means realistically to see those things, you have to be alone and quiet. The phone question? Paula is asking about the four immeasurables. May all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May they be free from suffering. That's a teaching on loving kindness. We aren't wishing those beings worldly happiness, you know, possessions and things like that. We're wishing them the happiness of contentment of heart, a more true happiness. It's distinguishing loving kindness from compassion. In terms of people being completely liberated from the mind, we think that kindness is wanting beings to be happy, and compassion is wanting them to be free from suffering. And all of it would be a deep peace of mind. And it goes on to have everyone resting in equanimity, free from attachment. So you're right. We use the word happiness, and he's trying to clarify attachment is different from happiness. And in our confused state, we think happiness comes from something outer, and therefore we're attached to other people and possessions. And we want the happiness to be inner. When we have that inner happiness, then when we see suffering beings, they're all our family. They're all dear to us. Carrie is saying how difficult it is to let go of everything. We have accumulated a lot of things, so it's physically difficult. And we've made all kinds of commitments, and we have all kinds of responsibilities. I remember when I met Venerable Dahani and I wanted to take the first program with her, it took me a year to have space in my life to take the first program. And you think, oh, you know, this Lama or that Lama is having that great program. And then you realize, oh, my goodness, I'm not free to do what I really want to do right now. And then you say, well, why am I not free? It's not like people think, oh, well, maybe it's easier to become a monk or nun and then someone takes care of you. Actually, we also take care of everything, you know, in terms of we have work to do in the monastery as well. Monasteries are fairly busy places. That internal solitude, whether it's in a monastery or in the world, has to come from your commitment to seeing where your mind is all the time. Unloading, even if it does take time, what can be unloaded. And so we think of Marpa, the great practitioner who was so key in the Kagyu lineage. And so he would accumulate huge amounts of wealth so that he could walk all the way to India, which was such a long way, and then he'd make offerings, tremendous offerings, since he knew how precious the teachings were and wanted to make offerings. Then he'd come back with the teachings, teach people, go back to his job, earn the money so he could go back to India. But he was clear the whole time, you know, I'm accumulating wealth not because I'm attached to it. It's because I want to make offerings for the teachings and go to the teachings. You know, he'd get to the teachings, the teacher would throw the money up in the air. It was his valuing of the preciousness and seeing how he was giving all of his wealth and accumulations for the precious teachings, and then he would go back and practice. So, you know, throughout time, when we look at the Kagyu lineages, there are lay people and monastic people, but they all use their minds moment to moment, whatever job they were in, to see where it was. Was it immovably peaceful so that the wisdom was uncovered, or was it occupied with this and that flitting around so quickly that you couldn't even see where it was going? And so while he was farming, his mind was on the Dharma. And while he was farming, his mind was deeply immersed in the practice, not worrying about, is this crop going to grow? Is it going to be rainy tomorrow? Is it all the millions of thoughts that pass through our minds all the time? Carrie did say how much the hand and foot example was important. And it's not a little thing. It's a profound example. You know, the fingers are lots of different parts. The toes are lots of different parts. I really got it when I saw a mother with a newborn. It was incredible. It was an incredible example to me. I went over to deliver some soup. The baby had been born just maybe 2 days. And the mother hadn't separated from the baby yet. So the mother had a few minutes to take a nap, and the father was holding the baby. The baby could not have been better cared for, but when I knocked on the door, the baby started crying, and the mother jumped up. The cry of the baby was still the cry of her own body. This is how we see our baby, and we want all beings to be our baby. So that instinctual, like the hand grabbing the foot, is instinctual to all suffering. Any further just responses? Folks on the phone. Day Chen is saying, yes, 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 and people still that are dear to us, who are suffering, push our buttons. And that is another reason why the sense is cultivating solitude to uncover greater wisdom so that you have the skill and tools to actually benefit those people. And in that period of solitude, the process in retreat, the buttons dissolve. The buttons are there because you still believe there is a self that's separate and different from other. The sense is our pain and our protection and the emotions that arise from that desire to protect ourselves are as great, the pain is as great as our belief in the self. This is exactly when it gets really interesting. So the lamas who are experienced in meditation, and Day Chen is a longtime meditator, your button gets pushed and you go, okay, I can see it now. I can see the moment it gets pushed now. I'm going to just run off, slam the door, and look at this very second. The first part of the button is just getting started. Let me see what that is. The earlier chapters help you see, okay, they provide a logic. Like the patience chapter provides a logic of how you can let go of the pain. This chapter talks about some of the worldly concerns. You know, is it because I'm trying to gain something or lose something? Is it my reputation? Is it disgrace? What is it that's pushing my button? And then the wisdom chapter, you look at the pain itself as an ephemeral thought that has no existence, that dissipates the second you look at it. So what is so profound and moving about Shantideva is he's giving you a full toolbox. So yes, exactly. You see the pain now. You see it earlier and earlier and earlier when your button is pushed. And eventually it gets to the point of, oh, yay, I can see it so clearly in this moment. This is the time I'm going to really undo it. It's the meditation allows you to see not only the gross level of thoughts, then to the more subtle level of thoughts. He's taking us more and more subtly through what our concerns are, down to the point where in the wisdom it's that the thought itself doesn't exist. Watch it disappear like a cloud. This process that we're doing, everything is built because he's given us so many tools and instructions on enthusiasm and why we want to do it. It starts with equalizing self and others. Then the next class is going to be exchanging self and others. And then the third class is, once you've accomplished those, then you are directly seeing wisdom. And what is that like? Is there a question online? Shania was giving a beautiful example of, in meditation, being able to be aware of the suffering of all the beings that she was there with and the great compassion of Buddha that sees all of that. And that is the direction the training is taking. Seeing all suffering as suffering itself, seeing all the beings, the nature of all the beings, opening our hearts to great compassion. At the ultimate, no separation between self and other, and in the relative, with the joy of just the swan landing in the lake, going into the hell realms to provide whatever gifts you and skill and wisdom that you can provide. When you think of the Dalai Lama and his favorite verse, that's in the dedication chapter, for as long as life exists and there are beings, so may I too remain in order to assuage the suffering of the world.